It's the Kim Munson Show, analyzing the most important stories.
Socialization of transportation, education, energy, housing, and water. What it means is that government controls it through rules and regulations.
The latest in politics and world affairs.
Under this guise of bipartisanship and nonpartisanship, it's actually tapped down the truth.
Today's current opinions and ideas.
On an equal field in the battle of ideas, mistruths or misconceptions, and it is getting us into a world of hurt.
Is it freedom or is it force? Let's have a conversation.
Indeed, let's have a conversation, and happy Monday to each and every one of you, and Merry Christmas to each and one every one of you as well. Thank you for joining us. Each of you, you're treasured, you're valued, you have a purpose today. Go out and strive for excellence. Take care of your heart, your soul, your mind, and your body, and really appreciate you. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well, and that's MONSON.com. I do love hearing from you. Love to say thank you to this great team that I get to work with as well, and that's producer Steve, Zach, Patty, Keith, Charlie, and all the folks over here at Crawford Broadcasting. It is December 14th, and the Electoral College is going to meet today. And my friends, I was up early today. I'm moving slow. My heart is a bit heavy with what's going to happen today. There's so many unknowns. But our constitutional republic is on the line right now. And I have no idea exactly how the good Lord is going to handle this whole thing. I really thought that the Supreme Court case that Texas was bringing forth was going to be our Hail Mary, and then the Supreme Court voted 7-2 on Friday not to hear that. And so we're in Hail Mary mode right now. I don't know what it's going to be exactly, because we are seeing Joe Biden and the radical activists that have taken over the Democrat Party. They are showing their hand, and it has me very concerned. Producer Steve, happy Monday to you.
Happy Monday. After everything you just said, happy Monday? Okay. I mean, you also included Merry Christmas. That I can get into, but happy Monday?
I know. It is a Monday morning.
You know, that 7-2 really bothers me, but one of the reasons put forth was maybe they were too concerned about igniting a civil war.
Actually, the Supreme Court justices, their job is to rule on the Constitution, and they are not supposed to be political on any of this stuff. Now, I know that they're human beings, and they are influenced somewhat, but their North Star, their foundation has got to be the Constitution, Steve.
I agree, and I'm I've been befuddled all weekend.
It has been somewhat befuddling for sure. We've got a very important show planned for you today. We will be talking with Rob Nadelson in the first and second segment. He had a really important piece that was in the Epoch Times about the Supreme Court cases give state legislatures the responsibility for resolving the contested presidential vote. I'm excited to hear what he has to say about that, and that'll be in segments 1 and 2. In segments 3 and 4, we'll talk with Cheryl Atkinson. You know her. She is an Emmy Award-winning reporter, and she is the host of, let's see here, her show airs on Sinclair TV. She's a 5-time Emmy Award winner. And we're going to be talking with her about her new book, which is Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism. We look at these issues, my friends, as freedom versus force, force versus freedom. Ultimately, if something's a good idea, you should not have to force people to do that. Our quote for today is Cheryl Atkinson. She says, obviously, if I cared about what people said about my reporting, I wouldn't be a good journalist. Or I could say, if I'm a Supreme Court justice and I care about what people think about my decisions, then maybe I'm not a good Supreme Court justice on that as well. Two headlines I want to bring forward to you. First of all, Patty had found this. This is a state article, and this is from the Colorado Politics. It says that 7 state departments are holding millions in revenue from fees in violation of allowed statutory reserves, according to the Colorado Office of the State Auditor's annual cash funds uncommitted reserves audit. And this found that as of June 30th, those 7 departments had $9.1 million in excess uncommitted cash reserves. And under the Taxpayers' Bill of Rights, they need to get rid of that. Basically, the departments are the Department of Agriculture, Department of Law, Department of Personnel and Administration, Department of Public Health and Environment, no surprise there, Department of Public Safety, Department of Regulatory Agencies, and Department of State. And it says under state law, they are required to either reduce fees or increase spending to eliminate the excess funds.
There might have been an eighth department there, the Department of Redundancy Department.
Touche. Good for you. And one other thing before we get to Rob Nadelson is Garfield County maneuvers around this red level mandate, and they declare their restaurants and other businesses critical. I've got to reach out to these guys and gals up there. Good for them. And Steve, you had mentioned that they border Pitkin County, where it's papers, please, if you want to get into Pitkin County.
They share a small section. I don't know how many miles it is, but if you look at the state map, there's a small section of common border between the two. And look, the two counties are totally at the different ends of the spectrum.
Yeah. If you're going to go someplace, go to Garfield County for sure. And we're going to reach out to them. On the line with me is Rob Nadelson. He is an expert regarding the Constitution. He's a former constitutional law professor. He's written a number of books, and it's great to have him on the line here. Rob Nadelson, welcome to the show.
It's good to be back. It's been a long time, hasn't it, Kim?
Yes, you were on sabbatical. You came back from sabbatical. Did you say, what has happened to our world?
Well, I sort of paid attention to what was going on in the world, but the sabbatical was a very good break. It was the first break from work in 46 years, so I don't feel guilty about it.
Well, for sure. Did you travel, or what did you do?
Well, the plan was to do some traveling. That was all prevented by the epidemic. The only traveling we did was throughout Colorado and also to renew contacts and see family in Montana.
Well, if you're going to travel, that's a couple of good places to do that.
I agree.
Let's jump
two
in.
Best states in the Union.
Well, true. Yeah. Two of the best states for sure. Let's jump into this important piece that you had in the Epoch Times, and it was reprinted in Complete Colorado regarding the Supreme Court cases give state legislatures responsibility for resolving the contested presidential vote. You published this, I think, at the end of November, Rob. Here we are, December 14th, the Electoral College is going to meet. A lot has happened. I'm concerned that state legislators, it takes courage to step forward. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, let's start at the beginning here. One thing that they don't teach you in school about the Constitution when they tell you about the legislative, executive, and judicial branches is that the state legislatures are put near the center of the Constitution. The state legislatures have a number of responsibilities. Everybody knows that they used to elect U.S. senators, but they have other responsibilities too. And those responsibilities are given to it directly by the Constitution itself. So, for example, when a constitutional amendment is proposed, it goes to the state legislatures usually for ratification, and the state legislatures operate independently, actually independent of their state constitutions, in deciding whether to ratify, because their power to ratify comes directly from the Constitution. The courts call this performing a federal function when this sort of thing happens. And another federal function that the state legislatures have is the federal function of deciding how presidential electors are chosen. In recognition of that, well, all of the state legislatures have decided that the people will choose the presidential electors within the state. But it's also recognized that sometimes an election on November 3rd doesn't produce a clear winner. And in that, so federal law has provided that if that happens, the state legislatures are then charged with coming up with a new election or a new slate of electors. Now, in six different states, the presidential election did not produce clear winners. And so, pursuant to both the Constitution and federal law, the state legislatures should have held hearings, assessed whether the election really did produce a clear winner, and if it had not, either provided for a new presidential election in the state, election just on the issue of the presidency, or chosen the electors itself. None of the state legislatures did that before the deadline, which is today.
Okay, so today, what is going to happen?
Okay, today, the certified electors from all 50 states and from the District of Columbia will meet in their respective state capitals, and they will vote for president. And the majority of those votes will go to Joe Biden, and that will be the end. That's it. And this is one reason, I think, why, well, when Texas brought its case before the Supreme Court, I thought it was a reasonable case, but there was no way the Supreme Court could give the relief that Texas wanted, which was to call the state legislatures into session to choose different electors, because there simply was not enough time. And let me just explain this briefly. There is a provision in the Constitution called the Same Day Clause. It empowers Congress to set a uniform time where we go to the polls to choose electors, and it also empowers Congress to choose a single day where all the state electors vote, and that day is today. And if a state legislature were to choose electors, say, tomorrow, they couldn't vote, but because by federal law, the voting would have had to occur today. So although there are some symbolic things that state legislatures who are disturbed about the election can do, there's nothing that changes it. Today is the drop-dead day. As of today, the election is over.
Okay, I saw something this weekend that Jenna Ellis, one of the attorneys for President Trump, said that there's something about early January, that that's really the drop-dead date. And I'm
No, she's wrong.
She's wrong.
And a lot of other people have said that, too. The date they're referring to is January 6th. January 6th is the day prescribed by law for Congress to meet, okay? So what happens is the House of Representatives and the Senate meet together in joint session. The president of the Senate, which is to say Vice President Joe Biden, presides. But he has very little power. He just presides. Then what happens is the ballots are brought in. They are opened and then handed over to tellers who then count them. Now, if there is a challenge from a state, if, for example, Arizona were to decide tomorrow, we want a competing slate of electors, they couldn't vote anyway, but I suppose because the voting is today. But Arizona could presumably send its competing slate to Congress. The problem is that in order for the competing slate to overturn the certified slate, you need the approval of both houses of Congress, not acting in joint session, but acting separately. So even if there were competing slates sent to Congress by Arizona or Wisconsin, they would not win over the certified electors because the Democrats have control of the House of Representatives, of the new House of Representatives. So this is the drop-dead date. And I've been saying that, by the way, for about 6 weeks. And I've been getting a lot of resistance from people who have been saying, can it really be? Oh, gee, it's just a statute. It's not just a statute. It's an execution of a provision in the Constitution, sets a firm deadline by which electors can vote.
Okay, Rob Nadelson, we're going to go to break. And these are questions that are difficult. It's like, why didn't these Republican state legislatures meet? Because we haven't really talked about the alleged fraud.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah, so
I think we need to talk about that.
Okay, yeah. We'll do that. We're going to go to break. Rob Nadelson is on the line with me. He is a constitutional expert. He taught law for many years up in Montana. He's written this book, The Original Constitution, What It Actually Said and Meant. And I think that that would be an excellent Christmas gift, my friends, with what is going on here in America. We need to understand that. So we're going to go to break. Before we do that, though, one of my partners is Castlegate Knives and Tools. They're located right here in Sedalia, Colorado. If you take Santa Fe south from Littleton on the way to Castle Rock, they're in Sedalia. I love Sedalia. It's such a taste of Americana. And it's a great place to do some of your Christmas shopping if you have a sportsman on your Christmas list, or if you have a collector, or how about a new set of knives for the kitchen. All those are lovely, lovely gifts. So go to Castlegate Knife and Tool, Or you can also go to their website. It's castlegate.com. They have that. It's recently been updated with all of their inventory. And again, that's castlegate.com. We're going to go to break. We'll be right back with Rob Nadelson.
Recently, rates in the mortgage market have hit near record lows. Lorne Levy with Polygon Financial notes that the COVID-19 Wuhan virus disruption has created potential opportunities to refinance your mortgage that could save you thousands of dollars. And for those senior listeners who may be looking for another source of income, exploring a reverse mortgage with Lorne Levy may be a solution. With over 17 years in the mortgage industry, Lorne Levy has the experience to answer your questions. Call Lorne Levy at 303-880-8881. That's 303-880-8881 for a mortgage checkup today.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com.
You've got to kiss an angel good morning.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. As many of you may know, Charlie Pride passed on this weekend, and he was really a trailblazer. He was one of the first black country and western stars, and rest in peace, Charlie Pride. On the line with me is Rob Nadelson. He is a constitutional expert. He has written the book, The Original Constitution, What It Actually Said and Meant. And he said that basically Joe Biden is going to be president once the electors meet today. Rob Nadelson, in the previous segment, we were talking about the state legislatures had the power on these contested states to meet and name another slate of electors. Why didn't they do that?
Well, first I want to say I had not heard that Charlie Pride died. This really is a lousy year, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mentioned that the Constitution kind of puts the state legislatures near the center of the system. They've got certain responsibilities. But this is something we've been seeing in the last few decades where state legislatures are not rising to those responsibilities. I mean, we see it also in the amendment process. There are some amendments like term limits that people desperately want that Congress won't pass because, of course, Congress doesn't want to term limit itself. The state legislatures have the power to have a convention called to propose a term limit amendment. They won't do it, even though something like 85, 90% of people favor term limits. And this is part of the same thing. The state legislatures should have hopped on this election problem right away. Now, I will say, you know, I've not dived into the facts state by state, but I have seen some of the affidavits, and I think there, at least in some of these states, there is some there. There were some very severe problems. and the state legislatures of those affected states needed to call themselves into session, hold hearings, and if necessary, have a snap election, new election, or choose the electors themselves. They didn't do it, and they had a whole long range of excuses. In Nevada, well, it's a Democratic legislature. They didn't want to reexamine the vote anyway. In Arizona, well, they have a Republican governor, but he wouldn't call them into session. In Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan, they have Democratic governors, and they wouldn't call them into session. It was one thing after another. What these folks didn't realize, and they were, and I will say that they were misadvised in many cases by the lawyers who work for the legislature. What they didn't realize is that they're performing a federal function. As I mentioned in the last segment, when they perform a federal function, including choosing electors or deciding on the manner of choosing electors, they don't need the governor. They can come into session no matter what the state constitution says if a majority of both houses agree. And they can establish their own rules at that point and decide what they're going to do with respect to the electors. But again, there were a combination of timidity on their part, the desire to pass the buck to others, bad advice given to them in some cases by their legislative lawyers, and then of course there's the fear that. Of the mainstream media. The mainstream media was going to say, Let's say, for example, Arizona had come into session. The mainstream media is going to take it for granted that Biden won Arizona. They're going to ignore the evidence to the contrary, and then they're going to bash the legislature for overriding the will of the people. And so when it came to the crunch, these state legislatures simply did not rise to the occasion in the same way the courts didn't rise to the occasion.
Do you think the Supreme Court should have taken that case from Texas?
No. No, that the Supreme Court was right to reject it, although they rejected that. They rejected it on the wrong grounds. They said that Texas had not demonstrated injury. But Texas had, in its papers, pointed out that it was acting not only as the state of Texas, but it was also acting parens patriae, which means literally parent of the country. They were acting on behalf of their citizens as well. And their citizens certainly did suffer damage. If the elections in the four states that were defendants were corrupt. On the other hand, there is another part of standing called redressability, where the court won't take a case if it can't see that it could actually do anything. And in this case, the Supreme Court could not have really done anything. They didn't have time. This thing wasn't filed until a week before the Electoral College votes, and so there was no way that the court could hold a hearing, listen to oral argument, make factual determinations, draft its order, issue its order to the state legislatures, have the state legislatures call into session, have them appoint a new electors. There's no way all of that could be done in a week. So the most the court could have done would be to void the Biden electors in the four states, but that wouldn't have been enough. Joe Biden still would have had a majority of those appointed, and so it wouldn't have changed the result of the election. So I think, although the court's grounds were wrong, they were really in a box there. Had this suit been filed, say, November 14th, that would have been a different circumstance.
You know, Rob, let's think about this, though. November 3rd, I think that Trump realized there was probably going to be some election fraud, but no. I think that none of us realized when we take a look at the allegations in these different states and the vote dump in the middle of the night. Now, that was November 3rd, and here we are at December 14th. That's a really tight time frame, first of all, for all of this to come forward. It took a while for us to realize what was going on, and I'm really concerned about our constitutional republic, and basically it's because we've run out of time. And
well, yeah, it makes you wonder, you know, it used to be that the president wasn't inaugurated till March. Back in the 1876 election, which was also highly contested, they had until March to work these things out. But the 20th Amendment was passed in the 1930s, and they tightened up the deadline, which is good in some ways, but it also leaves less time for working out a contest like this. I'll tell you, by and large, the Republicans did know that there was a real shady stuff going on by the day after the election. I mean, it wasn't like they had to wait 2 or 3 weeks to see what happened. I'll be honest with you. I think the Trump legal team made some strategic mistakes. They needed somewhat different personnel on that team than they had. I mean, I have huge admiration for Rudy Giuliani, but I don't know if this was really his thing. They needed some top civil litigators. They needed top PR people they didn't have, and they needed excellent strategists. So I'll give you one example. Because they're lawyers, they immediately thought, well, let's go to court, rather than thinking about the state legislative role. Mm-hmm. I am told that one of my columns in the Epoch Times was what finally changed caused them to change course. Now, I can't prove this or verify it, but that's what I've been told by a reliable source. And so after they saw my column, I said, gee, you know, here's a state legislative option. We haven't been pursuing it. But by that time, it was almost too late. And so, again, part of the problem was simply that the Trump team wasn't doing what it needed to do. It wasn't that the problem with the elections weren't known.
Okay, Rob Nadelson, we have just about a minute more. What is the thought you'd like to leave with our listeners today?
Well, I guess what I'd like to leave with is we now realize that the trite comment that we often hear, well, if we don't like something, we can vote people out of office or vote new people in office, that is no longer valid, that our presidential election system is at this point very vulnerable. We cannot count on the people's will being heard. And that means we have to pursue a different course. One of the reasons why I signed up with the Convention of States project, because as difficult as it is to get the state legislatures to do something, at least most of them are still pretty non-corrupt. I think we've lost a lot of our faith in federal elections, and it's going to be hard to get that back.
Well, I told Steve on my way in that my blood pressure was probably just, I wasn't going to take it today just because I didn't want to know. And you haven't helped it one bit, Rob Nadelson.
I'm sorry to bring the bringer of bad tidings, but I've always told you, like I've told every other radio host, you're going to get the facts from me, and you're going to get the law as best I can interpret it. I'm never going to sugarcoat it. I'm never going to tell you anything that isn't true, and I'm never going to put spin on it.
Well, Rob Nadelson, thank you so much, and highly recommend that people pick up your book, The Original Constitution, What It Actually Said and Meant. Thank you so much, Rob Nadelson.
Thank you.
Jason McBride, it is a day. Jason McBride with Presidential Wealth Management. The Electoral College meets today. Rob Nadelson said that Joe Biden is going to be our next president. What is the future saying about that, Jason McBride?
Well, the futures must be confused because they're up a little bit today, about 240 on the Dow. I don't know if that's all due to the same reasons with the Electoral College. There's still a lot more talk about vaccines and coronavirus than that as far as the market goes. But it's kind of a difficult pill to swallow for me, that's for sure. I don't know what the market is thinking. Friday it was pretty quiet. Today it looks like we'll have a fairly good day.
Well, it looks like Joe Biden is going to be the next president of the United States, and it is December 14th. My friends, we have been talking about it for several weeks now, these Roth IRAs. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have said your taxes are going to go up. And very possibly, if you want to save yourself in some taxes, you need to do something between now and the end of the year, Jason McBride.
Well, yeah, if they get in, and especially if they get the Senate, then they're going to be able to do
a Katie bar
lot.
The door.
Yeah, they'll be able to do a whole lot of things. Now, if we're able to hold the Senate, they can't do a lot with taxes, at least not right away. They could still do an awful lot with regulations, though, as
right.
we know, which may not affect your taxes too much, but it could have an effect on the economy, on companies, on the market. We just don't know, Kim. We just don't know.
Okay, question. For them to roll back the Trump tax cuts, would they need to have approval of both the Senate and the House of Representatives to do that?
I believe so. Yeah,
okay.
I believe to do tax policy or tax legislation, you have to have both, but they could do it during, what's that called, the reconciliation?
Oh, yeah.
Where they don't need...
Because that's how they did Obamacare, I think.
Well, yeah, and that's how Trump did his tax cuts as well. But, again, they've made it pretty clear if they get the Senate, they're just going to get rid of the filibuster and be able to do whatever they want with a simple majority.
Okay, so these Roth IRAs, the way I understand it, is that you would pay the taxes now on the money that goes into that, which that would be at a lower rate, and then when you take it out, there's not a tax consequence. Am I understanding that correctly, Jason?
Yeah, that's right, Kim. On a Roth, when you put the money in, you do not get a tax break now, so you pay the tax. But we're hoping that right now that the tax rates are low, so that's somewhat affordable. And then hopefully your money grows, and down the road when you take it out, either all at once, which most people don't do, or in payments or a little bit at a time, it'll be tax-free, so it won't matter if the tax rates have gone up substantially between the time you put the money in and you take it out.
Well, if you want to defend your hard earnings, the things that you've worked hard for, from it looks like a Biden-Harris presidency, call Jason McBride at Presidential Wealth Management. That phone number is 303-694-1600, 303-694-1600, and do that now before the end of the year. Jason, thank you. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
All right. Have a great show, Kim.
You bet. And we're going to go to break. When we come back, we will be talking with Cheryl Atkinson. She's written a really important book, and it is Slanted, and How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism. We will be right back.
Karen Levine has over 30 years in the real estate industry. The reaction to the COVID-19 Wuhan virus is presenting unprecedented and unpredictable opportunities and challenges in buying or selling your home. That is why you need to work with award-winning realtor Karen Levine. Karen Levine comes highly recommended by Kim Munson. Call award-winning realtor Karen Levine today at 303-877-7516. Karen's expertise will help guide you through this crazy real estate market. Call Karen Levine at 303-877-7516 today.
You'd like to get in touch with one of Kim Munson's sponsors, but you can't recall their phone number. Find a full list of advertising partners on Kim's website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim, MONSON.com.
And welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out my website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there. You'll get first look at all of our upcoming guests, as well as our most recent Sounding Off with Kim Munson podcasts and our most recent op-eds. Cheryl Atkinson, so many of you reach out to me when we have her on the show and say what fans you are of her. She is a woman that I really respect. The quote that we had for today, I quoted her. She said that she, obviously, if I cared what people said about my reporting, I wouldn't be a good journalist. And she is a great journalist. She's an American writer and host of the TV show Full Measure with Cheryl Atkinson. It airs on Sinclair TV. She's a 5-time Emmy Award winner and a Radio Television Digital News Association Edwin R. Murrow Award recipient. And she's a former investigative correspondent in the Washington Bureau for CBS News and a substitute anchor for the CBS Evening News. She has written a very important book. This is Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism. Cheryl Atkinson, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Kim.
It's a historic day. We had Rob Nadelson on before you, and he's a constitutional expert. He's written a book, The Original Constitution, What It Actually Said and Meant. And he says that today with the Electoral College that they will vote Joe Biden in as the next president of the United States. What's your thoughts on that, Cheryl?
Well, this is how the process works, of course. I'm a bit disappointed in the media trying to sort of take a viewpoint and lead the way in how things should turn out rather than reporting what was happening, the facts that were happening on the ground. And I don't see how it benefits journalism or the public for us in the media to have stepped in so quickly after the election with no evidence on our side to say that it was over and that there had been no, first we said no fraud, then we said no meaningful fraud, then no widespread fraud. And then when that was found, we said no systemic fraud. And then we said it wouldn't have made a difference. It's just disappointing to see the news coverage not really reflect, in my view, kind of what's happening and instead try to lead people down a path.
It seems like there's a 4 a.m. call, Cheryl, and there's going to be a word of the day. And for several weeks, it was baseless. But I find it somewhat curious how all the mainstream media, you hear the same words from all of them. What's your thoughts on that, Cheryl?
Well, I wrote about that in The Smear and again in Slanted. There's a chapter called The Verbiage of the Narrative. The whole without evidence, the whole liar phrase, that was all invented by propagandists and picked up by the media specifically to use and weaponize against President Trump. We had not done this before. And I explain how when you hear common language like that, that isn't common in daily life, it becomes sort of this, it's not organic. It becomes, as you say, more orchestrated. And it's because there's a smear industry of propagandists that's able to lead the way in news organizations, get their nose out of the tent, and dictate the terms of how we report things, the language that we use. But no longer, I think, Kim, are they just influencing us primarily from the outside, which is what I initially saw and observed years ago when I started writing about this. Now they're in our newsrooms. We've hired them. They are us. So it's no coincidence that the same language, the same terms, the same stories are being discussed largely in the same way wherever you look on the news.
Whatever happened to journalistic integrity? I see these young, for example, when President Trump, during the debates, it was more of a let's get Trump from some of these influential young female news personalities. Whatever happened to trying to get to journalistic integrity? What happened, Cheryl?
Well, news has been largely taken over by that industry of propagandists and talking point experts and political and corporate interests. They figured out how to do it. So you have to kind of look at journalism differently and understand that many people now have redefined what journalism is. It no longer is journaling the facts on the ground, hearing from different viewpoints and so on. It's convincing people to believe a particular narrative that benefits whatever interest you're ultimately serving or working for, often financial interest if you look, you know, a couple of layers down. So they accomplish their goal, even if they've reported something that's entirely false, wrong, or biased, if they further the narrative, which is why there are so many media mistakes the past 4 years at formerly well-respected news organizations. I mean, look at Associated Press and New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, the mistakes they've made, but very little consequence because they've accomplished their goal. They're not a news organization in the traditional sense anymore. They're places where they're trying to further propaganda and sway public opinion. And in that regard, they consider themselves, I think, very successful.
Well, I think that there are those in the American public that are complicit with this. Out here in Colorado, Cheryl, the real difficult voting block is the college-educated suburban woman. And many of them are my friends. And I have had conversations with them where it is almost like, don't tell me. There's no intellectual curiosity. The discussions are basically shut down. You have your truth, I have my truth. And I'm just very frustrated with, on an individual basis, the lack of intellectual curiosity and almost an arrogance that accompanies that, Cheryl.
I'm a little surprised, too, and I know some of the same types of people that you're talking about. I have very good friends in journalism and outside of journalism, live in different places, who feel much the same. And I, too, am surprised at the lack of their wanting to understand why they are being told to feel a certain way, or maybe to dig at the true facts. I mean, I heard somebody parrot the other day for the zillionth time, one of these analysts on television, false information about President Trump, something he actually didn't say or do, but it's just become so much part of the narrative, and people don't tend to question or seek the other side or see what's really true because they've been convinced, I think, quite successfully by the propagandists to just, for example, dislike Trump and not want to seek more information or find out more. So they've been convinced to vote, to not vote for somebody or not like somebody that they've decided tweets things or is nasty to people without really scratching beneath the surface and understanding, is that true? Why has it been portrayed that way? And who wants us to think that? What are they kind of steering us away from?
Do you think the Hunter Biden story, we're starting to see mainstream media tell that story, which it was really squelched throughout the election, these different contacts with China, with Russia. But now mainstream media is starting to tell these stories. And I've heard people or different news organizations say that they've interviewed people that have said, oh, my gosh, if I would have known that, I would not have voted for Joe Biden. What's your thoughts on that, Cheryl?
You know, it reminds me of, I have on good authority that before 2016, the New York Times found out quite early that there were three FBI chapters investigating the Clinton Foundation. I believe it was Little Rock, New York, and Washington, D.C., and held on to that information, didn't report it. By the way, whatever happened to those investigations, apparently nothing. But the point is, that would have been at one point in time pretty important news in terms of the election, and they chose to sit on it. Now, when would they ever do such a thing against their enemies or those who are, you know, they're not pushing the narrative for? For example, think of all the information leaked about President Trump. Anything harmful to Trump, even if false, was leaked. But anything helpful to Trump, even if true, seemed not to be leaked by these same agencies. And I think the media knew, you know, about a lot of this stuff. In fact, the left initially reported the Hunter Biden conflicts of interest quite thoroughly about a year ago, when I guess there was conflict among the left as to who should be the nominee. So there were people wanting to attack Biden. And then when he became the nominee, it was just, it went down the memory hole. Suddenly, if you talked about that, it was a right-wing conspiracy theory, even though the left had talked about it and reported on it, again, as I said, quite thoroughly. Now, you know, people ask me, well, what will happen under a Biden administration? And I think the answer is the press will throw a lot of softballs and have soft landings for his policies and whatever he does, but there will still be some tough reporting because, you know, there's disagreement just like among the right, there's disagreement among the left about what ought to happen. And when you see the left mainstream press reporting critical things about Biden, you should ask yourself who else in the left is trying to attack Joe Biden, because they're not doing it on behalf of neutrality or right-wing interests. They're doing it on behalf of other left-wing interests who have some other goal in mind.
I think that's the real question. I was talking with someone this weekend, and is it because then if Joe Biden would have to step down because of looks like what might be some real conflicts of interest, who gains? And then also somebody said, though, they did not think that Jill Biden would take that lightly. Now, I know this is all conjecture. You are a journalist. Not sure you want to comment on that. But let's go to break. Cheryl, you can let me know if you want to comment on that. And then what you see, you've had experience with this kind of government. I mean, that really, I think you've reported on that, and I think it's fascinating. So let's go to break. We're talking with Cheryl Atkison. Her latest book is Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism. I think it could be a very important Christmas gift. We'll be right back.
Predovich and Company understands that the COVID-19 Wuhan virus disruption has individuals and businesses scratching their heads with a variety of bookkeeping, tax planning, and accounting questions. Predovich & Company knows that you need trusted professionals to help you navigate these choppy waters. Kim Munson highly recommends Predovich & Company. Because of their advanced technological capabilities, Predovich & Company can help clients anywhere in the United States. Call Predovich & Company at 303-791-3000 to organize your personal and business finances. Call 303-791-3000 today.
Now more than ever, it is important to have independent voices bringing truth and clarity to the issues facing us, our families, our communities, our state, our nation, and our world. The Kim Munson Show is one of those important voices. Kim is a truly independent entrepreneur. She purchases her broadcast time, which gives her total freedom in production of the show and scheduling of guests. If you'd like to support The Kim Munson Show, go to her website, kimmunson.com, and click on the contribute button under Kim's picture. Kim greatly appreciates your help and support.
Greeting cards have all been sent.
Merry Christmas to each and every one of you, my listeners. It is the Christmas season, and wish you the very best with that. Be sure and check out my website. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there, and you can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. Before we get to Cheryl Atkison, one of my great partners is Hooters Restaurants out here in Colorado. They have five locations, Loveland, Aurora, Lone Tree, Westminster, Colorado Springs. With Governor Polis shutting down basically indoor dining, it is making it really difficult for our restaurants and our bars and our taverns. And let's step forward and help them, support them. Hooters Restaurants has all kinds of to-go specials. Go to HootersColorado.com where you can see those. Wednesdays are Wings Day, and their wings are so delicious. So be sure and check that out. On the line with me is Cheryl Akison, and she is the TV show host of Full Measure with Cheryl Akison. It airs on Sinclair TV, as she's a five-time Emmy Award winner. And Cheryl Akison, the question on the table now is, as the news media is now starting to report about Hunter Biden and all the things that he's been doing and the connections with his uncle and with his father, you mentioned who benefits on that. What's your thoughts?
Well, I tell people, when you watch the news today, sadly, what you have to do is, if you're going to be an informed news consumer, is ask yourself, when you see a story reported, who wants me to believe that and why? Because pretty much, as I described in my last book, The Smear, and this comes from the industry insiders who do this, every image that's put before you, every narrative, every story, is put there for a reason by somebody who sometimes paid a lot of money to get it there, to convince in either clever ways or just overt ways to get the news to talk about it, to take a certain viewpoint, to interview a certain person. And it makes me think of, you remember a couple of weeks ago when Attorney General Bill Barr was quoted by Associated Press as saying there had been no fraud that he saw, you know, of anything, mm-hmm. of any consequence in the election. Well, Associated Press didn't go out and dig up that interview and somehow, you know, pound the pavement and get that as a result. I have it on authority that Bill Barr called Associated Press, said he was ready to talk to them about some things. He wanted that message out at that point in time for some reason. I can't tell you why. But this is how news happens today. Powerful people call and make news or leak something or surreptitiously, you know, convince the news to be on point with a particular narrative. It's just not news reporting, I think, as many of us once thought of it.
Okay, Bill Barr, I found that so curious, Cheryl Akison. And then a day or two later, there was a report out that that Bill Barr said, oh, I didn't really say that. But you're saying he called the Associated Press and put that story out. Am I
right
connecting that dot correctly?
Right. And I think, you know, I didn't follow it as carefully as you may have, but I think when others in the administration were pretty surprised, since the FBI hadn't done any meaningful investigation, that he would make such a statement, that's when I think a spokesman at the Justice Department, I'm not sure Bill Barr, did any sort of clarification. I think a spokesman came out and said, well, you know, he didn't say where this is over. You know, he just said so far. And they, I think they were trying to mitigate what he said. But he got out, it's my impression, exactly for whatever reason, what he wanted to say at the time he wanted it said.
Cheryl Akison, you have been on this for a long time, and I had a friend of mine, Steve Peck, who was back in Washington, D.C. for the event this weekend, and I said that you were going to be on the show, and he is a great fan of yours. And I remember one of the interviews that you and I did. This was early on when you were starting to break some of these stories during the Obama administration. Was it the FBI that was spying on you? That in fact, one evening you were working at your computer and your cursor was moving on your computer around, but you weren't touching it. And that looked to me like a message to scare you. And I think I recall asking you, were you afraid? And you said, no, it made me mad. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that got conflated by propaganda, by Media Matters, as if that were the computer intrusion that I'm now suing the government over. The computer intrusion that I'm suing over, that was a whole, the incident you described was much later with a separate computer. The forensics and the computer intrusions that initially occurred, that CBS confirmed and announced when I worked there, happened, I think around, let's see, about the 2012 time period, 2011, 2012, when I was reporting some of these stories. And I didn't know the government was spying on me. I had some intel sources. You know, this is before Edward Snowden and all these other revelations. I had intel sources tell me that I was likely being monitored because of my work. And I had no idea, A, that that was happening, or B, exactly what that meant. But long story short, I was able to get sourcing to do some forensic examinations, which were then later confirmed by other independent exams that showed a long-term government monitoring effort to follow my keystrokes. They could activate my Skype app on my computer and listen in on audio when I couldn't tell the microphone was on. They exfiltrated files through using Skype. They accessed the CBS corporate and news systems, which CBS was able to verify, and planted classified documents deep in my operating system where I wouldn't even know how to get that or what that even is. And I've been suing ever since then because, of course, who holds those accountable? It should be the Department of Justice. They opened a case secretly, never told me, but cited me as a victim. I found out later through a FOIA request. If they're not going to hold their own accountable, who does it? I've been trying to sue in civil court since the government won't. It's basically protecting its own guilty agents using taxpayer money instead of apologizing and making sure it's not happening to others. And since then, by the way, Kim, I have a whistleblower in the case. A federal agent I'm suing is one of the agents involved in one of the operations against me who's admitted it, who says he doesn't want the case dropped because he now wants the truth to come to light. But how do you get, you know, you see how court systems work now. I used to think if you had your evidence, your plausible claims, your forensics exams, that it was sort of open and shut. Now I see the government can keep you from even getting into court. They fight on technicalities, not on what happened. They just, you know, fight. Statute of limitations, you filed in the wrong city, whatever it is. And spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, making sure you get nowhere. And it's just very frustrating because I tend to think, as I always did, it's not an important case because of me. But what we saw in 2016 done in the Trump campaign is an extension of these practices that our intel community has been doing and will continue to do if nobody's held accountable.
And this was under both Comey and another thing, one of our previous interviews, I said, was this under Comey? And you said it actually started before then. Who was the FBI director at that time, Cheryl?
Well, it was Eric Holder, was the attorney general. I guess it was Mueller. Is it Mueller? Right?
That's what you said.
I'm not even sure. Mm-hmm. But it was Rod Rosenstein. One of the initial operations was conducted out of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Baltimore under Rod Rosenstein, with the FBI reporting to not only Rod Rosenstein and not just me, but hundreds of people that were being illegally spied upon. But they were also reporting to an FBI official who went on and left the FBI to start the, I can't remember the name of the company that was the one that was called in by the Democrat National Committee when they said their servers had been breached. He started that company. Was it CrowdStrike?
It might be. I think so. I think it might be.
But anyway, there's all of these ties between the FBI, the surreptitious monitoring, and then later alleged mischief involving the Democrat server, which may or may not have really been breached by the Russians. And we have just a lot of evidence and forensic evidence, which is irrefutable, but very hard to get anybody to do anything about it.
Cheryl Akison, for those of us that are searching for truth, certainly I do a lot of opinion, but people know that it's opinion, and hopefully we're bringing forth information that people can use to process and then talk with their friends and their colleagues and family regarding this big battle of ideas that is raging in our country right now. But your experience under the Obama administration, and we see with the list of who Biden is putting into his cabinet and in key positions, these are not people that I think care about everyday hardworking Americans or care much about the Constitution or the constitutional republic. And you've had experience under this kind of administration. What's going to happen? Where do you go from here, Cheryl Akison?
Well, it just reminds me that there is, as I've called it before people said deep state, I always said, based on my experience in Washington, there's a persistent bureaucracy. And our intelligence community has it, and our federal agencies have it. These are institutions and people that stay in power, regardless of who's president, from administration to administration. And why on earth any administration at this stage would call upon the same old people, mired in controversies and all kinds of allegations from the past, rather than trying to find at least some fresh start and fresh faces, just reminds me that there's sort of a long-standing group, cabal of people who hold power and maintain power. I don't know what hold they have, if any, over you know, why they continue to be picked and continue to rise to the top. I mean, Sally Yates is being discussed as a high-ranking person. Jake Sullivan, who under Hillary Clinton of the State Department, was named as somebody present for a document sorting session in Benghazi so the documents weren't turned over to Congress in the basement of the State Department. Nobody ever did anything about that. Once a whistleblower from the State Department told me this, an Obama appointee, by the way, or an Obama person, once he revealed that this had happened, no law enforcement body ever interviewed him. Nobody did anything about it. And these people just continue to persist on and on in administrations. And I can't really explain that. I can't think that it's a positive thing for we, the public, to have those kinds of people supposedly working for us.
Okay. Hey, Cheryl Akison, first of all, thank you for joining us. And your book is Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism. We've got about 30 seconds left. What's your final thought that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I guess information is power, and I have great hope that tens of millions of Americans, however you stand on politics, voted for Trump, meaning they rejected the narrative and the person they were told to vote for because they see through some of the stuff that we're talking about. And in that, I do find some hope.
Well, Cheryl Akison, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Thank you for being the patriot that you are in searching for truth and reporting that in with great journalistic integrity. Thank you so much, and Merry Christmas to you and your family.
You too, Kim. Thank you.
And our quote for today is Cheryl Akison. She said, "I just don't care what people think. I'm just trying to do what I think is right." What a great American. My friends, today, be grateful, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, live honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. My friends, God bless you, and God bless America.